Welcome to this podcast from Christchurch London. For more information and resources, please go to christchurchlondon.org.
It's week six of a series of talks entitled The Heart of the Matter, which is basically how can we live an emotionally healthy life. And we've been looking at how our inner life, thoughts, feelings, emotions, shapes the way that we live, and how we need to process those emotions in a healthy way in a whole load of different areas like handling grief and loss, negative emotions, identity, relationships. And today, the title of the talk, no drum roll is needed, for it is Let's Talk About Sex. Oh, happy day. Now, I think it's worth acknowledging at the outset that Christians tend to get a little bit awkward when it comes to this topic. One of my funniest and most enduring memories of this church, some of you will remember this, was one of the first ever socials we did together as a church. We booked a huge boat that would take us down the Thames on a Saturday night while we all partied the night away. We sorted the boat, we printed the tickets, hundreds of people were going to come. It was going to be a great night. Only we forgot to attend to one teeny tiny detail. No one vetted the DJ. No one explained to the DJ that this was like a Christian thing, mainly attended by church people. And so as the music started and you all enthusiastically ran onto the dance floor, the first two songs he played, many you will remember, were one, I Want to Have Sex on the Beach, followed by number two, Horny, Horny, Horny. Not a word that's been used in a Christchurch London sermon before. I don't mean to be rude, but you lot have never looked more awkward in your lives. You were like, yeah, music party! Da-da-da-da-da. Oh, there's Dave Stroud. Never really liked the beach anyway. That's basically what you did. Us Christians get very awkward when it comes to this subject, and we don't talk about it much, which is a real shame. For there is much to be said. And there is no way we can do this topic justice in four talks, let alone one. Tonight I'm looking at the whole area of sex and relationships. Next Sunday it is Modern Romance with Liam Thatcher. That's a prospect. 2 weeks' time, I'll be talking at the whole area of sexual temptation and temptation more broadly. And then a couple of weeks after that into August, the wonderful Joe Wells will be looking at the subject of singleness. But even with these four different talks on different angles of relationships, there'll be things that we gloss over, things that we skim, things that we don't do justice. And I apologise in advance for that. It's not possible to cover everything. And so if you would like to talk in more depth about anything that is raised, please do grab myself, Liam, Joe, who'll be giving these talks. And even more importantly than that, if these talks raise any issues or emotions that you want to process in a safe, confidential environment, can I encourage you to email pastoralsupport@christchurchlondon.org. Sharon Mukungu, who heads up that team, is a qualified and trained counsellor, and she, alongside her husband Joseph, overseen by Lars, who's got 30 years' worth of pastoral experience, would be only too happy to meet with you, talk with you, and work out how you can process what's going on inside in the safest and healthiest way, and most effective way possible. The other thing I would point you to is the broadcast section of the Christchurch London website. If you type in love is a verb, you will find a whole load of talks that we did on similar subjects from different angles that we won't be covering in the same way during this series. And there is also the recording there of a Q&A we did at the end of that series, plus a page of book recommendations as well. If you want to dig a little deeper into any of this stuff, I suggest you start there. Okay, let's talk about sex. And to frame this talk, I want to refer to the best book I have read this year by far, full stop, which is Strong and Weak by Andy Crouch. Andy was with us in March this year. He's coming again in the second half of 2017. We're really excited about that. And this is a brilliant read. Very, very moving in places. And what he does is he talks about the two things that we particularly need to live a flourishing life and for our communities to flourish. He puts them in a two-by-two diagram. He calls them authority and vulnerability, and then elaborates on what he means by that. On the vertical scale, if we're to really flourish, we need meaningful action. We're created for purpose. For our communities to flourish, we are here to make a difference in this world. But of course, the other thing we need is also vulnerability. We aren't created to play it safe or to take the path of least resistance. We're to actually take risks. And as I've been praying about this talk and preparing it, I couldn't get this out of my mind. And I've been asking myself, what if we took this and applied it to the area of sex and relationships? So on the vertical scale, we all long for love. We all long for intimacy, for connection, for a flourishing sex life, I guess too. But of course, in order for that to happen, we also need vulnerability, honesty, openness, transparency. To quote C.S. Lewis, to love is to be vulnerable. And so we are going to be taking this as the lens through which we look at this subject, looking at different ways that sex can go very badly wrong, before finishing by looking at what a flourishing sex life might look like. And I want to start in the top left quadrant by looking at what happens when we go in search of meaningful relationships without vulnerability. Now, I'm sure some of you are thinking, oh, Andy's going to start by talking about pornography. Actually, no, we're going to get there. But the first thing I want to put in that box is religion. You see, more commonly, the way the church approaches this subject is someone like me stands in front of some wonderful people like you. And I start by talking about all the ways that you can go very badly wrong in the area of sex and how you are all very bad, nasty, naughty people if you do any of those things. That is not the way to flourishing in this area. I remember my background, very strict upbringing. Some of the advice I got was, boy, there are bad girls out there and you need to beware them. I mean, I was a teenager with hormones. I was like, bad girls? Where can I find them? That's basically how I felt. Long list of rules and regulations is not the way to find freedom and flourishing in this area. And incidentally, that approach probably comes from Augustine and his contemporaries, who had a whole load of temptations and struggles in this area. And as a result, a whole load of legalistic teaching developed around the church's approach to sex and relationships, characterized the church for centuries, I think did untold harm. The main fruit that religion produces full stop, let alone in the area of sex and relationships, is guilt and shame and versions of that. It puts burdens on people's backs, makes them feel not good enough. And if your experience of the church's approach and teaching on sex and relationship has been variations of guilt and shame, you need to know that is not the fruit of the Holy Spirit. That is not the way it is supposed to be. And I am deeply, deeply sorry. But the second thing that I think should go in this box, if religion goes there, is I think secular culture should go there too. You see, if we live in a culture that says this is what sex should look like, and therefore this is what sex should not look like, and therefore you should look this way and dress this way and have sex with this many people at this time and certainly not doing it like that, that will inadvertently produce variations of exactly the same kind of fruit, guilt and shame. Sense of unworthiness, insecurity, inadequacy. Am I really good enough to match up to culture standards? Secular culture and religion can produce exactly the same kinds of fruit. I want to show you a short video. If you play the video, this is a video from 1896 which depicts the first ever kiss recorded on film. It's actually from a short film entitled The Kiss. Just depicts a man and a woman nuzzling faces, talking with each other, and they end up actually engaging in a very short peck on the cheek. I'm not sure this is the way to do it. Someone asked me this morning if this is my mum and dad. No, it's from 1896. I'm not that old. But the reaction to this movie in 1896 was moral outrage. Critics described it as absolutely disgusting. The church in many quarters called for moral censure and reform. This was, incidentally, in a culture where you could be prosecuted for kissing in public. And yet, at the same time, at times during Victorian London, there were as many as one woman in the sex industry for every 12 men. The sex industry was rampant across this city and across this nation. Now, 120 years later, we can look back on that and think, they had a few blind spots back then, didn't they? Well, could it be 120 years from now, people will look back on the year 2016 and think, culture, maybe even the church, they had a few blind spots in this area. I think we must all approach the area of sex and relationships with an enormous degree of humility. You can tell a lot about what the culture thinks about sex by the language that it uses. We talk today about having sex. That implies it is a commodity that we can possess for my own pleasure. We talk about doing it. That's a gloriously romantic term, isn't it? Maybe it implies it's little more than a physical thing, a response to our bodily instincts. I think deep down we know that's not true. We know that sex is way more than a commodity or just a physical thing because of things like the devastating consequences of sexual abuse. When sex is forced on a man, woman, child against their will, it's not simply a physical thing, a bruise that heals over time. Often people can carry the consequences of that for the rest of their lives. We know that sex is way more than a physical thing Because of, for example, the deep pain as a result of sexual infidelity. If you've ever been in a room where a mum and dad have had to explain to their children of whatever age that they're not going to be together anymore because of sexual infidelity, you know you do not want to be in that room. It's not just a physical thing that you can write off. There is deep, raw, emotional pain there. Sex is way more than a physical thing. It is also an emotional thing. And the Bible seems to indicate it's also a spiritual thing too. First time sex gets mentioned in the Bible, probably Genesis chapter 4 and verse 1. It says this, Adam made love, we'll come back to that phrase in a moment, to his wife Eve. And she became pregnant and gave birth to Cain. She said, with the help of the Lord, I have brought forth a man. Notice, incidentally, who she does not mention. I wonder how Adam felt about his brief role in proceedings when she said that. When it comes to sex, the Bible seems to indicate that God, our spiritual lives, are involved as well. The New Testament talks about this too, probably most famously, 1 Corinthians 6. When talking about sex, it says this, don't you know your bodies are members of Christ himself? Don't you know your bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have received from God? You are not your own. You were bought at a price, therefore honor God with your bodies. When it comes to sex, our physical, our emotional and our spiritual lives are woven together in ways that are very difficult to untangle. One of the books I've read recently is called The End of Sex, written essentially by an academic called Donna Freitas. And this book was recommended by Gabe Lyons. I know some of you are aware of his work and fans of his work too. We are at Christchurch. He's got some really interesting things to say. This is basically a big research study into what in America is called hookup culture, where sex has been distilled to little more than a physical thing. You meet somebody, you might know them, you might not. You sleep together for physical pleasure, little more. The following morning, you go your separate ways. That's all there is to it. Well, she has surveyed thousands of students, and I think unsurprisingly, she has found that people have found it very difficult to disentangle the physical aspect of sex from other parts of their humanity. And as a result, amongst other things, it's left people deeply unfulfilled and incredibly isolated and lonely. Sex is way more than just a physical thing. I was talking to my wife, Joy, about this, and she was like, yeah, that is totally, totally the case. As an aside, we would both recommend this book here, The Five Love Languages, written by a guy called Gary Chapman. He talks about how love is about way more than simple physical touch. Quality time, giving of gifts, acts of service, words of affirmation. As Joy and I were talking, she was saying, like, yeah, this is totally true. Love is way more than simply the physical. She said, like, Andy, I can find you attractive when you are doing humble acts of service around the home. I find you attractive when you're holding our children and being really tender with them. I find you attractive when you're giving the kids a bath and doing something as simple as that. Well, this was news to me. I'm now coming back at 10 o'clock at night from work. Kids, get out of bed. It's bath time. I don't care how tired you are, get in that water right now. Joy, come watch. We all know, we laugh, but we know sex is about way more than a physical thing. And the language the Bible uses kind of touches on this, kind of characterizes this. Most common word used to describe sex in the Old Testament is the Hebrew word yada. It means to know. It's used over 500 times in the Old Testament for all kinds of knowing, but includes sexual knowing. It means to know, to study closely, to observe, to care for, to commit. Sex is personal, experiential, covenantal knowing. It is deeply intimate. It is incredibly vulnerable. And therefore, here is the problem that all of us face. You see, deep down, we all long for yada. We all long for that kind of intimacy, that kind of connection. But we hate vulnerability. We hate risk. We flee from any kind of possible rejection, negative emotions. If you've ever wondered why the pornography industry is a multi-billion dollar industry, this is the reason. Because we long for intimate connection, but we want to try and do it in the safest way possible. Really interesting study around this, around the Super Bowl final a couple of years ago. Seattle were playing Denver. And Seattle ended up thrashing the Broncos, right about by 43 points to 8. I mean, they just crushed them. Well, shortly after the end of that game, one of the world's biggest free porn sites released access data. They discovered that in Seattle, the home of the victors, at the end of the game, porn use was over 20% below the national average. In Denver, however, where they had experienced a crushing defeat, there was a 60% swing in an increase in porn use. Commenting on the results, a British journalist, Martin Daubney, put it like this: most men and women turn to porn not when they are happy, but when they are at their most vulnerable. We hate negative emotions. We hate vulnerability and we flee from it, but we long for connection. And it's not just pornography that goes in that top left box. Every time we search for meaningful connection without vulnerability, we end up there. And the number one reason, not the only reason, but the number one reason that that life philosophy does not work is because of the bottom right-hand corner, because it always creates victims. It always creates suffering. Where there is high levels of vulnerability and low levels of connection. Most obviously, victims of pornography and trafficking. Porn might create a sense of pleasure, gratification. It might titillate the senses. But we all know that's not a figment of our imagination on the screen in front of us or in the magazine that we are reading. This is a living, breathing person. And I am yet to meet a single parent that one day wants their child to grow up and be in the pornography industry. Yet to meet a single parent that wants their child to grow up and one day be trafficked, to be a sexual product at somebody else's disposal. The stats around porn right now, I think, are very sobering indeed. On the screen behind me is coming up a graph which shows an increase in people searching for terms like sex or porn online. Just to run through a few stats with you, the porn industry is now thought to be worth somewhere between $5 and $15 billion worldwide. 12% of all websites are thought to be pornographic. 25% of all search engine requests are thought to be for terms like pornography. There are 116,000 searches for child pornography every single day. And the average age at which a child now first views pornography is just 11 years old. I could go on and on and on about the stats. They are shocking. And they are the product of a culture that longs for relational connection and hates vulnerability. And if you are struggling with pornography right now, it is not enough for me to say, it is bad, stop it. That's not enough to help you find freedom. But actually what I need to do is help you realize there is brokenness and woundedness and insecurity in here. And porn won't help you fix it. In fact, it'll just make it worse. Part of the point of this series of talks is these emotions in here, we have to learn to process them in a healthy way. And just as an aside, if you think you might be addicted to pornography, porn will not help you live a flourishing life. And most probably you need professional counseling. That will be Sharon Mukungu's recommendation, head of our pastoral team as well. In a society that is obsessed with porn, there will be countless victims. And it is right and good that the church stands up and says, this needs to change for the sake of the victims. But it's not just victims of pornography and trafficking that go in that bottom right-hand corner. Actually, in a society that views sex as a commodity that I can have purely for my pleasure, one of the offshoots will be that people feel like products. Am I a good enough product? How do I compare with other products on the shelf? Might I be left on the shelf? I know that you know this, but they even airbrush the models in magazines. You know what that means? That means even the professional models aren't a good enough product. Even the professional models need a computer to make them look a good enough product. In a society where nobody is a good enough product, what a society that tells us you have to look like this, what does that do to our insides? It's a very, very moving documentary called The Mask That You Live In. Featured a quite brilliant psychologist called Philip Zimbardo. He was one of the guys behind the Stanford prison experiment in the 1970s. Brilliant, brilliant guy. And in this moment, he takes a group of young people, largely guys, and he gives them all a bit of paper and he asks them to write down what they think of themselves on the outside and what they'd like to look like and be. Then they turn over the piece of paper and they write down what they honestly think about themselves on the inside. Then they script the bit of paper, they throw it around this big room, and then they go and pick up somebody else's bit of paper and they read what somebody else has anonymously put down. You can kind of guess the results. What do people want to be on the outside? Good looking. Desirable. Admirable. Impressive. Strong. Handsome. How do people feel on the inside? Lonely. Unworthy. Sad. Insecure. I have no friends. I wonder if anyone here can relate to that. Do we often attend to how the outside looks more than the inside? That's the product of a culture that says sex, and therefore people are commodities that you can have. And you know one of the greatest ironies of all? That if we choose to live that way, we attend to the outside and not the inside, it means you can even be having sex and not experiencing yada. Because no one will really know what's going on inside. And for the few people on earth who seem to make that top left quadrant work, because they're such a beautiful product, they're so great on the outside, they can have sex with whomever they want, whenever they want, however they want. That life philosophy only works until they get rejected themselves. Age and beauty catch up with everyone eventually, and then they have to deal with all the pain and rejection that comes from that. Which means, ultimately, that the ultimate victims of a society that sees sex and therefore people as products are the very people who try and live that way. Let me explain to you how it works. If I see sex and therefore people as products, if I want to get a kick of satisfaction when someone turns and looks at me and thinks I look good enough, well, that will inherently make me more selfish because I'm after people for my own good. That will in turn mean I push more people away because I'm more concerned with me than I am with them. Probably I'll create victims as well. But if I push people away, that makes me more lonely. If I'm more lonely because I have less connections, that heightens my need for meaningful connection because I've got even less of it. So I go after more of the product. That means I push even more people away. That makes me even more selfish. That makes me even more lonely. And that heightens my need even more for meaningful connection. And you follow the trajectory enough, I need bigger hits and higher highs. And I need more and more and more of a product that satisfies me less and less and less. How are you doing in this area? I find it fascinating that the effects of pornography and sexual fantasy is when they've studied the brains of people who are really just in the grip of it, their brains turn out to be very similar to the brains of those who are struggling with drug and alcohol dependency. It actually shrinks the brain. It's just one of the ways that we can become victims when we chase this stuff. It has power. Look at more of that in 2 weeks' time. But in a society that sees sex and relationships and people as a commodity, there will be countless victims. Not just of pornography and trafficking, but everybody who thinks, am I falling into a system whereby I and those around me are simply products and nothing more? You know, as a society, we will have to deal with all the isolation, loneliness, anxiety, and mental health issues that come from that way of living. But before we look at what a flourishing sex life might look like, I want to look at the bottom left-hand corner. Low levels of meaningful connection with other people, but also low levels of vulnerability. This is what we call withdrawing or hiding. Interestingly, when Andy Crouch first started teaching on the material in his brilliant book, way more broadly than simply sex and relationships, at the end of his talk, he offered a chance for people to come forward and get prayer. The vast majority of people said they were in that box. And it kind of got me thinking, when it comes to relational connection, if we love it and want it so much, why would people go down there? I think two main reasons, passivity and fear. Let's look at passivity first. You see, the thing is if yada is this powerful, deep, intimate knowing of another person, then very simply, you can't know somebody in a night. You can't know somebody in a week or a month or a year. It is a lifelong journey of knowing somebody else. That's one of the reasons why God's protective packaging around yada is marriage, where you are committing to somebody for the long term. But very simply, when you decide to do that, that is hard work. Because you're not only taking on the good, the electricity and the passion, but you're also taking on the bad. One person said, good marriages might be made in heaven, but so are tornadoes. I think that's quite a clever metaphor. Actually, if you are going to commit to somebody for the long term, it is tough. When I was younger, I naively thought that sex might be like Hollywood. You know, it's great, but it really isn't. Most mornings I wake up with bogies in my nose and blotches on my face and my breath is so foul it could probably kill a small horse. They don't show that in Hollywood, do they? It is tough. One of the main reasons marriages fail is they stop working when it gets tough. That one of the main causes of marital disagreements is over division of labor issues. When you feel like you are giving more than you are getting. It can often happen, but not always, when young children come along. Let me give you an example. Joe and I, when we had particularly young children, I would go to work for the day and I would work really hard. And I would come home from my job thinking, my day's work is done. It's now time for me to rest. But when you have young children, there's still work that needs to be done around the home. Nappies to change. Toys to be tidied away. Kids to be put to bed. I felt like I've done my day's work. Joy's just been playing with the kids all day. It should be her job. Joy felt that attitude in me was selfish. I tried to tell her, my mom doesn't think that I'm selfish, which didn't really go down very well at all. One of the things I've learned, you want to build a great marriage, you give more than you get. It is hard work. That's why we do the marriage course. It's recognition that this lifelong yada, this lifelong knowing of another person, it's hard work. And it just gives you tools to be able to work at it over the long term. One of the tools that it gives you, which just always makes me chuckle, is they say, look, when you're having one of these disagreements, one of these fallings out, you know, don't blurt out the first thing that comes into your head. That can be hurtful. Instead, slow it all down. Ask questions. You know, ask questions. Don't blurt out what comes into your mind. Ask questions. Let me just tell you, it doesn't always work. A short while ago, true story, Joy and I were having a falling out disagreement, starts to get a bit heated. And for some reason, I remembered this piece of advice. Don't blurt out what comes into your head. Ask questions. I slowed it all down. Here's the question I ask. Honey, why are you being a psycho right now? That didn't work at all. It was okay. I made a bath a bit later. It was great. You know, marriage is hard work. It is this lifelong knowing of another person. You don't just know the good, you also know the bad. One of the pieces of advice I got before I got married is if you want to be a great husband, be a student of your wife. You want to be a great father, be a student of your kids. Study them. What are the cute little things they do? What are the cute little things she says? What are the cute little things that she likes? The more you get to know her, the more you end up loving her. Oh, I love it when you respond like that. The more you love her, the more you'll want to get to know her more. The more you want to get to know her more, the more you love her. This is what theologians call sibi mutuo causae. It means mutual causes of each other. The more you know about something, the more you love it. And that's not just emotional and social, it's also physical as well. If you read Dr. Doug Rosenau's book, Celebration of Sex, this guy coming up, he's a Christian sex therapist. I did not know such things existed. But he talks about actually in marriage, there's a lifelong journey of physically knowing somebody else as well. This is probably a book that those of you who are married or getting married might find helpful to read. It's on the recommended book list on the website. But when you get to know somebody else, over the long term, it is tough. And just to say one thing, this lifelong journey of yada, it starts way before you get married. Can I say something that's at risk of being a little controversial? One of the reasons I think our society is so obsessed with internet relationships is because it's less hard work than genuine face-to-face interaction with other people. Before I dated Joy, I did internet dating for a bit. Now, I want to make it clear, I am for internet dating. It is a good thing. It can be a great thing. As with all things, it's the motive of the heart that matters. But while I was internet dating, I realized some things about the motives of my own heart. Let me just share vulnerably my sin issues with you. Firstly, I realized that while I was doing it, I was treating people as products, making snap judgments. I like you, I don't like you. I like you, I don't like you. I was just a consumer. Secondly, I realized that in doing internet dating, actually, it was because I was scared of the proactivity needed to ask somebody out face to face. Third reason I realized, self-revelation, that I was doing internet dating was because I realized if this relationship ever did go wrong, well, it would happen away from the niceness and the cleanness of my church community. It'd be much more clinical. I wouldn't have to spoil what's going on in the goldfish bowl of church life with a broken relationship. And I just realized, oh man, if I'm going to really flourish in this area, I need to close my internet dating account down and I need to be more proactive. Just to repeat, I think internet dating can be a brilliant thing. But test the motives of your heart. It's a lifelong journey of hard work getting to know somebody else. But of course, the other thing that keeps us in this bottom corner, it's not just unwillingness to take on hard work, it's fear. You see, yada is not just a lifelong journey of knowing somebody else. It's also a lifelong journey of being known. That can be scary when somebody knows even the bits that you don't like about yourself. That is scary. There's this wonderful phrase that describes Adam and Eve in Genesis 2, verse 25. It says, they were naked and they felt no shame. I think that's quite powerful when you think about it. When you're naked, you see every bit. Even the bits you think, oh, I'm embarrassed by that. Oh, I hate that bit about me. And yet someone's committed to you anyway. Very powerful. One of the resources you may want to look at is called Laugh Your Way to a Better Marriage, given by a guy called Mark Gunger. It's kind of like stand-up comedy with teeth. It's got some real meat, some pretty decent content. And one of the things he says is that most affairs actually start more for emotional reasons than for sexual ones. I agree with him. Let me give you an example. A few years ago, I was chatting with a married couple. And we were just passing the time of day, having a good conversation. But at one point during the conversation, the guy let slip a great dream for his future. Now, the dream wasn't fully thought through. It had a few holes in, but it was still a dream. And in the banter of the moment, the wife shot back, oh, you'd be rubbish at that. You'd totally fail at that. Oh, imagine how you'd mess that up. Now, she missed the moment completely. I saw the expression on his face. It was like a bit of him died. And I thought to myself, you're not going to want to open up about that particular dream to the person that you're married to. Just as an aside, if you are married and you are not talking about your dreams for the future, you may want to go and get some help. You may be in way more trouble than you think you are. Here's the reason. Take that couple. This guy has just had his dream shot down, making myself vulnerable. Oh, now I want to go and hide. All it takes is for that guy to be in the office a few days later and the dream plops out in a different context. And this time somebody else says, wow, that's an amazing dream. You'd be amazing at that. I totally believe you could accomplish that. And all of a sudden, you've got acceptance of my vulnerability over here. You've got vulnerability and connection that you don't have with your spouse over there. And then there is trouble. Give you another example. See it happen regularly. Couple are going out for an evening. And one half of the couple has just made a really special effort. Put on a really nice outfit, done their hair, booked the restaurant, got everything sorted. Are they going to like it? What will they think? Will they like me? And the other half just says nothing. They don't acknowledge the nice outfit. No thanks for, oh, it's great to spend time together. One half has opened themselves up and they got nothing back and it just makes them want to hide. And all it takes is for that person to be in a different context. And somebody to say, I love what you're wearing. Love what you've done with your hair. And suddenly, wow, you see me and you like me. You've got connection, vulnerability, intimacy over here that you don't have with your spouse over there. And then there's trouble. If you've wondered why the start of relationships can be so powerful and so intoxicating, it's not just because you are physically attracted to the other person. It's because you think, wow, they see some of me and they might like me. Wow, so powerful. So seductive. We'll look at that more in 2 weeks' time. But actually, we are all little and vulnerable inside. We all have very fragile egos. And therefore, the power of marriage is not just in the hard work needed to know somebody else, but the vulnerability needed to be known. Oh, you see this little habit I've got. And you see this way of thinking and this fear and this insecurity and you still accept me? Wow. So here's the $64 billion question. How do we move up and to the right? How do we flourish in this area? How do we have deep, intimate connection with those around us? How do we have a healthy sex life too? I want to suggest three very simple things. Number one, we all need to show more proactivity and more vulnerability. We all need to take steps to move up and to the right. My journey of yada with joy actually started the moment I asked her out. That wasn't just proactive, it was vulnerable. It was hard to go to Joy and say, hey Joy, do you want to go for a drink one night this week? Send. That was tough because she might have rejected me. Maybe one of the best proactive and vulnerable steps you can do is ask somebody out on the back of this talk. And just to say this, is that if you do it, it might not work out. Last time I spoke on this material, somebody did just that. They asked somebody out on a date and it did not work out. Here's what I would say to them and to anyone else to whom that happens. It's even if you expose yourself, you make yourself vulnerable and you don't get the answer that you want, it is still the path to a flourishing life. And you will flourish way more than if you hide down in that bottom corner. I have way more respect for people who try and it doesn't work out than those who don't try at all. Give it a go. Maybe your proactive, vulnerable step is you need to get married. Now, the riskiest thing I've ever done, marrying Joy. You know, one of the things that used to really irritate me about adults when I was growing up was their answer to the question, how do you know when you found the one? How do you know deep down when you found the person you're supposed to spend the rest of your life with? What did they always say? How'd you know? You just know. Really irritating, isn't it? Let me tell you this, you never know. You never, ever, ever know. The Bible gives you a few guidelines as to what a great partner might look like, but you never fully know. I was in love with my wife, Joy, on our wedding day, but I did not know for sure she wasn't a vampire. Sometimes since I have wondered. I'll run a bath tonight, it's going to be fine, don't worry. But you never know. That's what yada is for. It's a lifelong journey of knowing. And when you start to know somebody, you find bits that you love and bits that you don't love so much. But that works both ways. And so maybe the most proactive and vulnerable step you can take on the back of this talk, to quote the great theologian Beyoncé, you need to put a ring on it. It's an anecdote from beyond 1999. I just want to acknowledge that. Thank you very much. Modern day illustrations, I can do them too. Maybe your proactive, vulnerable step is you need to get help. Maybe that's what your action is. Now, I have said repeatedly through this series, I repeat it now, and I sincerely mean it. This church is to be a place where it is okay not to be okay. And all of us, me included, we come into church with our nice exteriors. We all have brokenness on the inside, whether it's to do with this area or not. I don't know what is inside you right now. Maybe you're struggling with pornography, sexual fantasy, image issues, insecurity, fear. We are so for you. This is a safe place. And whatever you confess, we love you and we want the best for you. Maybe getting prayer, talking to your connect group leader, chatting to a friend, emailing pastoralsupport@christchurchlondon.org. Maybe it'll be the bravest thing you've ever done, but it could be the most significant step onto the most wonderful path to a flourishing and free life. We all need to be more proactive and we need to be more vulnerable. Secondly, though, second application is we need to build great community. You see, it's not enough for me to stand here and say, everybody be more proactive, be more vulnerable. Because probably in a community like this, there are going to be people who feel stuck in those other three boxes, particularly in this bottom right one. Victims who feel like I am as vulnerable as I could possibly feel. And I don't know any possible proactive steps that I can take given what's going on inside me right now. You know, what we're shooting for is not just personal flourishing, but corporate flourishing in this area. For those of you who are married, do you have the kind of community around you? Do you have the kind of closeness of friendships whereby you can ask them and they can ask you, how is your sex life? If you don't, maybe you need to start on a journey whereby in 6 months or 12 months time, you can. I'm going to guess if you've not got that community, you can't start there this week. If you meet a couple for the first time, don't get them round and start there. That's just awkward. But what you can do is start opening a little bit of yourself up, being honest with those around you. So maybe in the future, maybe this time next year, you can have those conversations. For those of you who are single, you know, if your dar is this lifelong journey of knowing, and therefore commitment is essential, what it means is this: if you're not in a committed relationship, then God's best plan for you is that you are celibate, that you don't have sex. Because if you are outside the committed relationship, then chances are at some point the danger is you're going to make somebody else a victim. Because you've not said, I'm going to commit to you for better or for worse. You find out something you don't like, oh, I'll find somebody else, thank you very much. And you treat them like a product and you create a victim. Or they do that with you, or both. If you're living a celibate lifestyle, that can be really tough. And more than that, if yadar is so wonderful, if it's so intimate, if it's so powerful, it's totally normal as a single person to look at it and say, I'd really like that, and I don't know when it's going to come my way. Is this the kind of place, is this the kind of community where you can say, I'm single and I'm finding it challenging right now, and that doesn't mean you're needy, and it doesn't mean you're desperate, and that's totally normal and fine to feel that way? I tell you what, if we can crack this, I think London will take notice. Because I have very rarely seen that kind of authenticity and vulnerability in community, even in the church. All too often, people settle for far too shallow a community. Have you got friends who can ask you, how's your thought life? Have you got friends who can ask you, how's your self-image? That kind of closeness doesn't come immediately. But if really we really work at it, in and through our connect groups maybe over the next year, maybe we can get there. That's what I'm really believing for. If we're to flourish in this area, we don't just need to take proactive and vulnerable steps, we need to really smash it when it comes to community. And then thirdly and finally, we need Jesus Christ. This isn't just a tweet end to the talk, or let's just put Jesus in. Actually, when the Bible describes yada, this deep knowing and this deep loving, actually it's one of the most common phrases in the Old Testament used to describe God's love for us. Actually, full and final yada is not actually found in sex, it's found in Jesus Christ. I love how 1 John 4 puts it. This is love, not that we love God, that ain't love. If he's perfect, I mean, how can you not love him? This is love, that he loves us. He sees what you did last week. He sees what you thought last night. He sees what you think of that person sitting over there, and boy, oh boy, does he love you. It's very, very powerful. I was doing some training with some leaders from Christchurch a couple of weeks ago. Some of you were there, forgive the repetition. But I love the interaction with Jesus and the woman at the well, this woman with a hugely checkered sexual history, very broken life. It's the longest conversation that Jesus has with anyone in the Gospels. This broken woman gives her such grace, such dignity. Her life is changed. She runs back to her village. She says, come, meet the man who told me everything I ever did. It's not what Jesus did, of course, but it's how he made her feel. That's what encountering Jesus does in here. It's like, oh, he's peeled back every layer of the onion, even the worst bits, and he still loves me. When Ephesians 5 describes this power of sexual union, he says, Paul says, this is a mysterious picture of something far better, Jesus' love for the church. Commenting on that verse, Tim Keller, who's just a brilliant leader in New York, who I know many of you respect and love, he says this, the ecstasy and joy of sex is supposed to be a foretaste of the complete ecstasy and joy of total union with Christ. The moment we see Christ face to face, we'll be naked, yet so delighted in our nakedness, we'll be unashamed. The Lord God will look at us through Jesus and say, I love you. Great sex is a parable of the gospel. To be utterly accepted in spite of your sin, to be loved by the one you admire to the sky. You know what this means is this, in essence. You can be utterly known, more fully alive, more deeply satisfied, and more overwhelmingly delighted yet content without ever having sex. Life in all its fullness does not need sex. And the reason that we know this is the one who has lived more fully alive than anyone who has ever lived before or since died as a virgin, age 33. You know, one of the things I love about Jesus most is he didn't stand in that top right corner saying, I'm living a flourishing life. Everyone, be more proactive, be more vulnerable, come up to where I am. No, 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 no. He dived into the weakness, the dirtiness, the frailness of humanity. He faced every temptation that you and I have ever faced and ever will face. Gave up his very life. You can't be more vulnerable than being dead in order to free us from the power and the slavery of sin. Oh, that's why I love him so much. Have you experienced that knowing? You can again tonight. Come all over again and meet the man who told you everything you ever did. Maybe the band want to come up. I want to finish with this illustration. Little bonus illustration for you. I didn't mention to any of the morning congregations. There's a pastor called David Hegg. And he tells a story that I've shared before at church, but quite a while ago. Some of you may remember it if you were around then. Of a guy who came to him with a very promiscuous lifestyle. I mean, he just slept with loads and loads of people and he loved it and he hated it. He just felt overwhelmed by the power of lust, but he just desperately wanted to be free. He's like, Pastor, can you help me? David Hegg gave him a little illustration. He said, just imagine tomorrow evening, you're with a girl, and this inevitable power of lust is coming over you, and you're just powerless to stop it, and you're about to have sex. Imagine I walk into your bedroom at that moment. Bit awkward, I know. But once we get over that, imagine I offered you $1 million if you stopped having sex with that woman right then. What would you do? This guy was like, well, duh. I'll stop having sex and take the money. Thank you very much. David Hegg replies, well, what happened to that overwhelming power of lust that you couldn't control? There was a moment of silence. He says this, "We both realized a very simple truth. One passion seems irresistible till a greater passion comes along. An overwhelming passion for righteousness is actually a mindset the Bible calls faith. Here's a helpful definition of this kind of overwhelming faith. It is a life-dominating conviction that all God has for me is better by far than anything I can obtain through selfishness and sin." If we really want to flourish and to know the freedom that Yada brings, the security, I'm known and yet I'm loved, you won't find it fully and finally in sex. You'll find it fully and finally in a much greater passion, and his name is Jesus.
Thank you for listening. For more information or for further podcasts and downloads, please visit christchurchlondon.org.